Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. Joining me as tonight's co-host, appearing tonight courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger. Josh is by now well known as a frequent guest and co-host on Your Legal Rights. Mr. Borger practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of areas. Our upcoming discussion on social media and the First Amendment has been rescheduled for April 7th. So if you're here for that program, please stay with us. Even if you weren't, please tune in next week for what will be an amazing program. And that's not to sell tonight's program short. Employment law has been the hot topic for the last couple of years. This has not diminished over the past year with the pandemic, with racial unrest, and a seemingly unstoppable political divide. So that poses some questions. Can an employer require an employee to get vaccinated as a condition of employment? What of religious beliefs? What if you are handling food? What if you're working amongst people in really close proximity, such as a prison or a school? If you have questions regarding employment law, especially in light of recent events, give us a call. Our number in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. That's, of course, if you're in the Bay Area. If you're not, call us toll-free. Our number is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, our attorney guests cannot give you specific legal advice. We don't have all of the salient facts of your situation, but we're happy to share the legal principles to help guide your decision-making or maybe direct you where you can find some help. You can contact us with any question of employment law. You're not limited to the point where we may be in our conversation. And to help guide us through this update on what's happening now in the field of employment law and how it affects you, Josh Borger, now you're with us. Would you like to start the introductions?
Absolutely. San Jose attorney Lisa Chapman is our first guest. She's an employment and litigation attorney. After a 10-year stint in L.A., 20 years ago, the Bay Area lured her back. Her client base includes companies with a handful of employees, as well as companies with hundreds of employees. Lisa spends most of her time trying to help companies get out of their own way and avoid getting sued for employment-related mistakes. She counsels companies on everything from employment-related and issues and serves as general counsel for many companies. When an ounce of prevention isn't enough, Lisa represents companies in employment and civil litigation in federal and state courts, before the Department of Labor, Standards and Enforcement, the EDD, the U.S. Department of Labor, and the EEOC. She also conducts workplace employment investigations and trainings.
And probably her strongest credential, as we were discussing before the show, is that, like myself, Lisa Chapman cut her teeth in this business, in the legal business in L.A., found that things were different down there. And how do you turn down the Bay Area when you're born and raised here, see what a better place is like, but you've been cutting your teeth in L.A.? Also joining us tonight from San Jose's Wagley Employment Law, Jenny Wagley has exclusively practiced employment law and representing hundreds of companies from two-employee startups to giant mega corporations. Jenny's early career focused on litigation, both single plaintiff and class action. But in the last few years, she has narrowed her focus to what she loves best, advice and counsel. From employee handbooks to commission plans to executive agreements to offer letters, Jenny has seen it all, but it never gets old. Jenny, Lisa, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
Glad to be here. And for the record, I also cut my teeth in LA, so we are a triumvirate.
You also went to my alma mater, but that's not what people want to hear tonight. So of all the topics, I mean, we've had a lot of things that are going on in society in the last year between the pandemic and racial strife and the political divide, as I discussed earlier, which I just don't see a recent end to that. It seems like one of the things that we're looking at are that people see things differently. They look differently. They experience things differently. And that brings us to our first topic. Josh, you want to jump into that?
Sure. One of the things that's scaring a lot of people these days, myself included, is the onslaught of hate, especially towards Asians these days. And there is no doubt that this hate, that this vitriol that's everywhere you look, is unfortunately going to pervade the workplace in certain instances. So let's talk about what you do in that instance when, as an employee or as an employer, what happens when an employee makes a racially derogatory remark to a fellow employee, both sometimes when they intend it to be, or sometimes because they offend them and they don't intend it to be, but it is taken in an offensive manner. What do you do as the employee? What do you do as the employer?
So starting with the perspective of the employer, what do you do when an employee comes to you and tells you that he's not being treated the same or she's not being treated the same as coworkers because of whatever it may be, whether it's gender or skin color or ethnic origin, whatever it may be, what should an employer do next? Lisa, this looks like it has your name written all over it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've got this case 3 times right now. What an employer has to do and what an employee has to do are it's didactic, 2 different approaches. For an employer, they are obligated under California and federal law to immediately stop the presses and conduct an external workplace investigation by someone who knows how to do that. And this is not the HR person inside the company. They need to hire someone who's a lawyer, who knows what they're doing, and who's going to go through the rank and file and address all of the complaints that are made and come to conclusions, factual conclusions, about the truth or falsity of the complaint. At that point, it's turned over to the lawyer for the company, and the lawyers have to decide if there's a violation. It's a heavy lift. It's very expensive, and it needs to happen. As I said, right now I'm managing several of these for my clients. From the employee side, the employee who feels that they've been mistreated, they need to file a complaint with their employer. They probably need to figure out if this is going to mean they're going to lose their job, but they need to at least consider that, but then hopefully take the step of asserting a complaint. Then the company's obligated to conduct the investigation, et cetera. And the employee should hold fast on requiring that the employer do the proper investigation required under California law. And then, you know, from there, it's all off to the races. What happens after that? I'm curious as to, Jenny, what you think. I'm going to pass it off to you, see if you have anything to add on that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you've said. And I think it's important also to speak to those employees who witness something in the workplace or nearby. You know, if you are a management level employee in California, you are required to report to the company any kind of discriminatory or harassing behavior. And legally speaking, harassing means giving someone trouble on the basis of a protected category like race, sex, religion, et cetera. It doesn't just mean being mean to someone. If you're not a management level employee, you don't have to legally report it, but I do think a best practice is for companies to encourage everyone to come forward. And some companies now are setting up anonymous email reporting lines or 1-800 numbers so that employees can report these things. And then once the company hears about it, as Lisa said, then their obligation to investigate kicks in. They don't have to know who complained in order to do that.
Can I add, Jenny, that I think companies and individuals working in companies need to understand that managers are personally responsible for sexual harassment and discrimination claims. So if an employee claims sexual harassment, discrimination, et cetera, it's possible that the managers and supervisors will be personally liable.
That's right.
Well, let me follow up on that. What if you tell your friend, a coworker, this thing that happened, this horrible thing, and you tell him or her not to tell anyone? Can they make you that guarantee? What if you tell your supervisor the same thing and tell them, but you don't want to make it a big deal? Don't tell anyone.
Nope. No can do. Not if they're management level. They have to. If they're not legally obligated to report it, then it's really just a personal ethical choice whether or not they're going to keep it confidential. But unfortunately, however you view it, that's not seen as important as making sure that these things get addressed in California.
And I would add that there's there's personal liability for those folks. So, I mean, report it, don't report it, you're still on the hook. You know, there's an email saying that someone told you about it. So you as a supervisor, you're going to live with that forever.
Well, let me failure to prevent and treat discrimination is a claim of action all on its own. So if there's evidence that you knew and didn't do anything about it, that makes it even worse for you.
Okay, as is a failure to conduct a proper investigation. That's a separate cause of action.
Well, let's talk about that investigation. There's going to be some people that there's a lot of small businesses out there. You may employ a few people and someone makes a claim of harassment. Are you telling me that it's best practices to hire an attorney? Some people can't afford to do that. So what do? You want to do the right thing. You also don't want to get sued. Can you do your own investigation, or do you, as a matter of law, have to hire a high-priced attorney that some can't afford?
It can be someone in-house, it can be an attorney, or it can be a licensed private investigator. Those are your three choices. Lisa and I, of course, always endorse the external investigator because they're neutral. They're completely neutral. But if you don't have the resources for it, it can be done in-house, yes.
I agree, Jenny. I mean, it's really an economic limitation issue. And I think companies should aim to get that proper external, but yeah.
Well, people are bringing their political opinions, their social opinions. Some would say there's almost no distinction anymore, but they're bringing it into the workplace. People are bringing their politics into the workplace. They're bringing everything they carry, all their opinions in. What rights do they have to put up a sign on their desk, to do something to express how they feel about what's happening in the world? And what rights does the employer have to say, take that sign down? You know, we support gay rights, but someone else says it's against my religion. I don't support it. And I want to make sure people know that. What are the rights here?
All right, I'll take that. What are the rights? So companies, it's interesting. Everyone thinks they have this First Amendment right to free speech. Well, no, not really. It doesn't really work that way. That doesn't apply to private companies. So the way it works is if you post on Facebook some hate speech, some, you know, fill in the blank comment that's perceived negatively, the customers of a company can challenge that and contact a company, and the company... I have a number of clients that have come to me and said, there's all this hate speech that my employees have put on, you know, Facebook, and I need to fire them because I've got my clients that want to fire me if I don't fire this guy. And you know what? I think that's legal. I mean, there are limits to that, but, you know, as a private company, you are not obligated to, you know, challenge that hate speech behavior. Does that answer your question, Josh, or am I being too?
Well, there's a lot of speech out there that doesn't qualify as hate speech. Someone has speech and, you know, let's take it down. Not everyone is on the fringes, but someone may have religious views that don't really match the views of their employer. It's not hate speech, but they have views that disagree. It could be on abortion. It could be on gay rights. It could be on any number of topics. But let's say it's not hate speech, but they want people to know their employer's stance of supporting abortion causes is offensive to them. So they put up a sign of some sort. It's not an offensive sign, but it's letting people know that they disagree with their employer. What are the rights in this instance is when you have a disagreement, but it's not meant to be offensive, but other people might take it offensively?
You know, there's a great example of that. I'm going to ask you to factor this in, Lisa, because it might help frame your answer a little bit. But there was a case out of the North Bay where a restaurant worker, I believe a waitress, wore a Black Lives Matter cap into her work. And it wasn't compliant necessarily with the uniform that everyone was wearing. And there got to be a disagreement about whether she was terminated over content or whether they simply said, wear your uniform, and she was never terminated. But these things are happening right now, and it may be a political issue, it may be a religious issue, But sometimes people take a very strong position that may not jibe with that of their employer.
Yeah, and right now I'm not aware of a case that really answers that question of whether or not wearing a BLM, you know, hat is going to address this issue. I think at this point the law is companies have a right to terminate their employers when they say offensive things. I think the BLM hat issue addresses a different issue, which is that discrimination by the company. So I kind of pivot right now with the facts you just gave me to a different issue, which is that discrimination? Is the company discriminating against someone for on a legitimate grounds?
And I think this brings us to an answer that nobody ever wants to hear from a lawyer, which is it depends. You know, every time this comes up, it's going to be a very fact-intensive case by case where you have to weigh, was this political speech that would be considered protected versus was this speech that would be considered unlawful discrimination? If it falls into both categories, which one is more protected than the other? And in the example you had, Jeff, with the uniform violation, you know, if they do have a uniform uniform policy that's universally applied, regardless of what's on someone's hat, then they can legitimately make the argument that it's non-discriminatory to say, you know, no, don't wear that hat. But what if they don't have a policy like that in place and they assert that that was their reasoning after the fact, right? It's just going to come down to each and every situation.
Or Jenny, what if an employee, I'm asking you this, what if an employee felt that hat restriction was discriminatory, right? You can see how it could go even another layer deeper, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they would be advised to report that up the chain at the company. And there are, you know, this is how policies evolve and change.
And Jenny, you raised an interesting topic when you talked about political speech, because California is one of those states that says it's in the labor code, as you all know, you cannot be fired for political speech. My reading, at least, of that in looking through the case laws, political speech is interpreted very broadly. It is not just going to the ballot box anymore. California Supreme Court has applied that to very specifically to gay rights, to marching for women's rights, all different minority rights. And so, for example, there was someone who went to the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, went back to Berkeley where he worked, and there was a disagreement of whether the employer could fire him or not. So you could run into this conundrum in California. If Californians like to protest and you have this person there, it goes on social media. And if you keep them, people aren't going to frequent your business. If you fire them, you could get sued. It's a conundrum in California. What are you supposed to do as the employer in this circumstance? And what if your employees won't work with this person?
So let me talk about that, because I've actually had this situation with a number of my clients. And they have been threatened on Facebook that customers, clients, whatever, are going to withdraw their business because of the hateful speech of their employees on Facebook. And they're being trolled. I get it. And we have advised, and most people I know that do what I do advise clients to say, you know, it's legitimate to not allow these folks to continue to work with the company, because they're destroying the business of the company by their hateful speech. They're creating images, you know, in the public mind that this is a discriminatory company, et cetera. And I think they have a right. I'm curious, Jenny, do you disagree? I feel pretty strongly about that. Jenny?
No, I agree. But I do think that we have no idea how the courts would feel about this at this point, right? It hasn't come up recently. It's been almost a decade since we've had one of these cases.
Yeah.
You know, it would be really interesting to see what they would have to say about it. But I do think companies do have a lot of leeway when they feel that employees are acting in an unlawful manner and that's discriminatory. I would want them to err on the side of prevention as opposed to worrying about being in violation of the political speech claim.
It's a bit of a Hobbesian choice in California, because if they're not doing something unlawful in their free time, but they're talking on Facebook and other people are perceiving it to be offensive, but it doesn't constitute hate speech, you could get sued for firing the person, and you could lose your business if you don't, because people won't frequent your business.
Yeah, but Josh, it all goes back to the First Amendment. That's the basic argument that I've seen everyone make. And I think that that's a, I think that that's yet to be decided by the courts, but I'm curious to see what you think. I know you pretty well. I think you're going to agree with me. I think that it's a legitimate approach.
Yeah, I think so too. And I personally would rather have my client be sued by someone who engaged in behavior that was offensive to other employees and clients be terminated than the other way around.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden, and joining me tonight as co-host is Josh Borger. Tonight, we're taking a look at current issues in employment law. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topics, employment law, especially as it relates to some of the newer issues that are happening right now. You're not limited, though, to the exact point we may be in our conversation. You know, we talked a little bit about some of these environmental issues and what to do with some of the political speech and the like. But that brings up, you know, what do you do? What's the best way for an employer to handle it when you have an employee who's just a jerk?
And there's different levels of jerkiness, right? I mean, there's jerkiness that violates the law if someone makes comments that do fall under that umbrella of discrimination. Then you have every right to take action against them and fire them. You actually, you know, I want to reassert that California is an at-will state. You can fire anybody for any reason as long as it's not an unlawful reason, and there's only a small handful of those. But, you know, whether or not your company policy is to get rid of people just for being jerks who are unpleasant to work with, that's really more of a company best practices issue. But I'm seeing more and more my clients are having no jerks allowed policies where they have zero tolerance for bullies, even though those people aren't acting illegally. They're really upsetting the balance. They're driving away good employees. So I still think it's worthwhile for companies to train. And we do have to train about abusive conduct here in California, even though it's not illegal, interestingly. And I think companies should focus on rooting out that kind of behavior. It's been tolerated for a long time, but I think the environment is really shifting. What do you think, Lisa?
Unmuting. So sorry, Jenny. I completely agree with you. I feel like we're moving towards this continuum where tolerance is minimized. And the hard part, Jenny, I see is that we always have to think about discrimination issues when we advise our clients to terminate people or when they make those decisions. And employees, oftentimes the employees who are the worst offenders of proper behavior are the ones that are going to claim discrimination, and you have to just be very mindful of it. Do you agree, Jenny?
That's very true. Yes, the bad actors are the yeah, definitely.
It's like a 1%.
You know, the other side of this is you have an employee that believes that there's a hostile work environment. And it may be because of someone they don't get along with, or it may be because of management. Can you tell us what is a hostile work environment?
Well, it's not a work environment that's hostile. That's what I always tell people. It sounds like that's what it is, but there's a very specific legal definition of hostility. A hostile work environment is one in which you are discriminated against. You're experiencing harassment based on your membership in a protected class. It's just because your manager is a real meanie and treats you with hostility, that doesn't make a hostile work environment. Would you agree?
Bravo, Jenny. That's exactly what I say to our clients as well. It's got to be based on your status as a member of a quote unquote protected class, which is hard for folks to appreciate because they only know their micro situation. They don't know the macro situation in their company. It could be systemic, and it's really hard for folks to figure that out. Right, Jenny?
Yeah, and it's a really misleading term, hostile work environment. I mean, I understand why it's so commonly misunderstood. It's not intuitive at all.
You know, you brought up a phrase that we've all heard, and I'm not sure that people really know what it means. What is a protected class? My question is, does that mean that you're in one of these groups that have historically been picked on or through some status that has been picked on? Or is it the opposite? We're merely making that distinction between genders or between race. Is it self-protected, whether you're in the minority or the majority?
Go for it, Jenny. I think we have the same answer.
All right. You're both pointing to one another like out of extreme deference, but yeah. jump in, Jenny. You drew the short straw.
Well, so California has protected categories and the federal government has protected categories, and California's list is a lot longer. So basically, this is any group that has historically been marginalized. Of course, the federal list is too short. It does not include enough categories, in my opinion. California's is one of the longest, if not the longest. So it's got the standard, race, color, sex, nationality, religion. And then in California, we go deeper into genetic information. Like you might have a predisposition for a particular illness and you can't be fired for that. There's sexual orientation, which now fortunately is protected under federal law. We've gone into the weeds on what sex and race mean. So natural hairstyles are protected under the race category. So that's really what it refers to are groups that cannot be discriminated against on the basis of being a member of that group. Did I get everything, Lisa?
I would add it's county by county. Like in San Francisco, this includes height and weight.
That's true. That's true.
So
that's rare, though, right? San Francisco is a unique bird.
San Francisco is a unicorn, yeah. But these are local law, like all of California, everything's a local law. So you've got the federal law, then you've got the state law, then you've got your county law, and then you have your city law. So I think San Francisco is the only true outlier on height, weight. I think there's a couple of other kind of interesting demarcations to think about. Yeah.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We'll be back right after this.
If you haven't heard of Willie Dunn, well, you're in for a treat. His songwriting was right up there with Leonard Cohen or Neil Young. And beyond that, Willie laid the groundwork for modern Indigenous music. Willie Dunn's son, Lawrence, on finding a new audience for his dad. That's coming up on Q from PRX.
And that will be a 7 o'clock check-in for Q from the CBC here on KALW San Francisco at 91.7 FM. And online at kalw.org. And support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For the details, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org. This is KALW San Francisco, and now back to Your Legal Rights with Jeff Hayden.
Let's jump in a little bit and start talking about COVID. A lot of their employment laws, a lot of these situations are new in so many areas of the law, including COVID. One question that keeps coming up, though, is can an employer force their employees to get a vaccine?
Yes.
Jenny, I'm going to challenge you on that. Okay.
Well, the Department of Fair Employment and Housing was nice enough to come out and say pretty much, yes, you can force them to get vaccines, but there are a lot of qualifiers, right? You do have to accommodate sincerely held religious beliefs and practices, which I know is an issue with this vaccine. My understanding is that all of the COVID vaccines are made with fetal tissue, which is a big no-no for some people, according to their religion. And so they may or may not be able to get out of getting the vaccine because of that. I mean, if they have a job where they literally can't do the job without getting the vaccine, then they may not be able to not get it. But that's just one of the qualifiers. Overall, the simple answer is that, yes, they can. But there are these extenuating circumstances.
I would add to that that Jehovah's Witnesses as well, folks with that religious belief are exonerated from this requirement because they have a belief that requires them not to engage in certain medical practices. So based on my review of this area, folks making that claim have to be able to establish that they are a very serious practitioner of that religion, and you know, they've got to provide the details to their employer, and that could potentially set up a discrimination claim if they are let go, if the employer does not honor those claims.
But the employer might have a legitimate reason not to honor them. You know, like let's say that the employer is a daycare center and the all of the employees are teachers who are in constant contact with large numbers of the public. There may not be an alternate job that an unvaccinated employee could take, which is one of the ways that you accommodate people. So the company in that sense would be legally allowed to say, I'm sorry, you know, at least until this epidemic is over, you can't work here. So yeah, they might file a discrimination claim, but I don't think they'd win.
So I think that's a really interesting issue. And I think it's going to be up to the courts to see how that plays out, Jenny, but I completely agree with you. On the other hand, there's this countervailing, you know, point of view, you know, that they've got, that there are these inherent rights that folks have. But Josh, you were going to say something?
I think Jeff was actually.
Jeff.
Actually, you've answered two of my follow-up questions. I was going to ask in the global sense of the question, and ultimately, doesn't it really come down to balancing? If somebody works in an office and they have legitimately held religious beliefs, there may be a better way to accommodate other people's reservations by simply putting them in a closed office or some type of partitions. If they work in a restaurant, it may be quite the opposite, where there's really nothing that you can do to protect the public from an unvaccinated person.
And there's a legal term for that balancing act, which is the interactive process. So the company and the individual, they engage in this formalized process of back and forth, where first the employee says, I can't get the vaccine for ABC reason. And then the company says, well, what do you need? You know, what else? How could we accommodate you? They think about different ways. Maybe there's a way, maybe there isn't. And at the end of the day, the company doesn't have to do anything that would be unreasonably burdensome on them. But they do have to reasonably accommodate. So what that means, the courts are going to tell us what that means in the COVID context eventually.
I'll just add really, really super quickly. It requires a lot of documentation for companies. You know, if you know, when you're faced with these issues, you need to document this really carefully and have counsel that's guiding you, because you're creating a lot of risks for your company as you, you know, walk down this path. Right, Jenny?
Call your lawyer.
Giving you sort of like a broad brush, but it's not a broad brush.
Well, Go ahead, Jeff. One step further. The person who doesn't want to get a vaccine, and it's not for religious reasons, maybe they're an atheist. Maybe they think there's just going to be herd immunity. They don't trust the vaccine. There may be side effects 50 years from now. We really don't know. And they'd rather everyone else gets it, and they don't. And they think they'll be fine with herd immunity. Can you fire that person? It's not for religious reasons, so it doesn't have any hint of the First Amendment around there.
Wow, you just raised like the roughest question that you could possibly raise in an hour and 35 minutes.
You're welcome.
Jenny,
you know that, but the state has helped us out a little bit. A few weeks ago, they published some guidance on this issue, and they did say that if someone does not have a legitimate disability or religious belief claim, that the employer does not have to reasonably accommodate their opposition to the vaccine. As long as they're not requiring people to get it in a discriminatory way, if it's a uniform policy and someone says, sorry, I just don't want it, I don't think it's necessary, I say, based on what California is telling us, that they could fire them. You disagree, Lisa?
I didn't finish my sentence before you jumped in. So I agree. No, it's totally fine. I agree with what you say. However, I also look at it as like a cautionary situation for a company. Like, what are you going to spend on litigation? So how careful do you want to be? You're looking at $250K to dispute a lawsuit. So like, think about the economic cost of a lawsuit. But definitely consult your lawyer, because I think Jenny and I are on the same page about the risk, but it's very expensive. So, you know, you don't just make that decision on the fly. It's very pricey. Like, it's not something to make lightly. And check in with your insurance provider. Do you have insurance coverage? And folks listening, please all get EPLI and insurance coverage. Jenny, please echo that. Get as much insurance coverage as you can for your companies, and that'll help you if you get sued. Right, Jenny?
And I would say, to your point, just, you know, unlawful activity and activity that gets you sued are not in the same category. People can sue you for whatever reason they want, whether or not you were in the right. And as Lisa said, you'll spend so much money digging yourself out of that hole that it is a very delicate dance.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. As you can tell, my guests are both very animated and very interested in the topic. I would think that you listeners would be as well. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. You know that already. Tonight, we're taking a look at current issues in employment law, but we're talking about really trendy issues, things that are really happening right now. You should give us a call. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're not in the San Francisco area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can call regarding any question on tonight's topic of employment law. You don't have to talk about where and jump in where we are in our conversation, but we're talking about stuff straight out of the news right now. That's the most important stuff there is. You know, one last question I had before we move away from the COVID stuff is, I heard about a new law that just went into effect yesterday that talks about additional personal time off for people who need to take time off due to COVID or related to the impact of COVID on their life. Who would like to take in a stab? And I see Lisa, you're with a thumb up. Would you like to jump in on that?
Yeah, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but basically there's a California passed a statute. It went into effect 2 days ago, provides for supplemental COVID relief paid sick leave. So individuals, employees get 2 additional weeks. That's 80 hours, by the way. It only applies to companies with more than 25 employees. It's the tricky part is it's retroactive to January 1, 21. I would say it expires on September 30th, 2021. What it does is it expands it. So not only just provides this leave, but expands what was in effect last spring, the reasons why you can take this leave. So this includes time off for vaccine appointments, government and doctor's appointments related to quarantines, time off for quarantines that doctors have told you have to have, care for your family members and quarantines that they have to have. So, so basically it expands what we had, you know, back in the spring of 2020. And it's a big deal. And this is really also important. There's a poster that companies now need to post. It's really a big deal. And also payroll providers have to track all this COVID leave on their, on their documentation for wage statements. There's a whole new documentation level that has to happen. So companies need to make sure, you know, ADP or whoever they're using, and if they're using QuickBooks, they're in trouble. They need to get a proper documentation of that. Jenny, do you have anything to add?
I just want to call out for people who are thinking, oh, well, we only have one person in California. Everyone else is in Minnesota. We're fine. This law covers employers with 25 employees anywhere. So, and a lot of companies now do have a distributed workforce thanks to COVID, and they're spread out all over, but that won't get them out of complying with this one.
Let me turn it to Bobby from Oakland. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. You know, I'm wondering how it seems from what I've been hearing that employees really have a lot of rights and can kind of call their own shots. It's probably not true, but it seems like it would be hard to be an employer because you have to account for so many divergent approaches to being an employee. And but then on the other hand, I hear about companies like Amazon that seem to be able to control almost every movement their employees make. And don't they have to account for people's, like, religious beliefs, maybe needing to say a prayer or not come in on a certain day? Can you help me resolve this, what I see as this tension between these two points of view?
Well, man, you've really gotten to the heart of the matter of employment law very quickly. You're absolutely right on both counts. It is really hard to be an employer, particularly in California, with all of the wonderful protections that we have for employees. But mostly it's hard for small businesses because they don't have the resources to hire a team of lawyers to protect them or come up with creative arguments when they don't do what they're supposed to or aren't perceived as doing what they're supposed to. I can't speak to the practices of any particular company like Amazon, but I do know that large companies have very large legal budgets. So they can more or less make their own rules sometimes. Now, in my experience, all those companies do try very hard to be compliant. And a lot of what you hear about them not being compliant is not necessarily true. There's a lot of scuttlebutt out there about what companies are doing. But I do think that it comes down to economics and scale. What would you say, Lisa?
Jenny, you just like summed up everything I'm thinking. And I have these conversations every day about let's budget how much time we're going to spend on this issue. And it could be a $20,000 issue, but we're going to spend $1,000. And I think the problem is, I think the infrastructure of the state and, you know, no knock against the plaintiff's attorneys of the world, because I do represent some individuals occasionally, but the system is kind of skewed against companies because it's very expensive to fight these claims. And I think, Jenny, you and I will agree, we very often find ourselves in the position of telling our clients to figure out the cheapest economical solution. And then we tell them how to clean up their situation going forward, which I would just say is a plug to every company out there that's listening. Any company owners, get your house clean, clean it up. That's the best way to avoid all these legal fees. Get proper policies, procedures, compliance, et cetera. And there's HR consultants that, you know, not just lawyers, but HR consultants, and Jenny and I can share them with you, who can do that on a cheaper level than what Jenny and I can provide. Right, Jenny? Don't you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
Bobby, I hope that answered your question, Bobby. Thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights.
Thank you much.
Thank you. Have a great night. Let me turn it to Ken from Kensington. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, good evening. I just want to clarify one thing that one of your speakers said about fetal cells in the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. There is no fetal material in those vaccines, neither that for Johnson & Johnson. The confusion is fetal cells versus fetal cell lines. What's in the Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer was used to demonstrate their efficacy was fetal cell line. These came from aborted fetuses 4 to 5 decades ago which have gone through serial reproduction thousands of times. There is no fetal material in those vaccines today. It's fetal line. It's a fetal cell line, not fetal cells.
Thank you. I was the one who misspoke about that. And you are absolutely right. And thank you for shedding more light on that. And I think that that is part of why it's going to be so complex when the courts are deciding about religious accommodation here. Because what if someone says, I couldn't get the cell, I couldn't get the vaccine because of these cells. And yet we have the science saying that, you know, it's not exactly what they're claiming it is. How is the court going to come out? Do they have a religious right to not get the vaccine? We don't know. I think that's hugely up in the air.
Well, the issue is fetal material, and there's no fetal material in those vaccines. Well,
right, and the courts might say it's something different, right? The courts might say if there's any connection.
And isn't that a question of, folks, isn't that a question of facts? And that a question of fact is what a jury has to decide, right?
Ultimately, I think it comes down to the perspective of the person making the decision. And if they're making it on a religious basis, they may not see that distinction the same way as somebody might from a medical or a scientific basis. We'll see where it goes in the courts. But Ken, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Good program.
Thank you. Josh, you're still muted. I'll jump in. Somebody has a physical problem and they're not sure how to get the support that they need. Or similarly, you have an employee who has a physical problem and may need some greater support, whether it's a specialized desk or a ramp to get in the door, whatever it is. Can you talk a little bit about what rights they do and don't have? And similarly, what the employer has as far as a duty to accommodate versus their rights to have a functioning workplace.
This actually dovetails really cleanly with the vaccine question. It's the same principle, and also with protected categories. So disability is a protected category. What constitutes a disability? I mean, we could have an entire month-long show about that. It's broader than you might think. And there is this duty to engage in this interactive process again. So I think, without going into too much detail, employees who feel like they need support should absolutely be asking for it, because there may be a lot more available than they realize. They might be entitled to more frequent breaks or a different schedule or supportive equipment that the company would pay for. But employers also have to know that whenever they catch wind of someone having a physical or mental or a health issue, they need to be on it. They need to be proactive. And this is part of what Lisa's saying with having a clean house and having documentation. You don't want to let any of this go below the radar and just proactively engage in that interactive process. And then it's, you're protected and also the employee's protected.
Let me take us down a slightly different line now that my mic is back. So one of the current topics that...
Welcome back, Josh.
Thank you very much. It's the problem with the internet. It's there 1 minute and you realize you're talking to yourself the next. It's like being back in my house. So let's talk about a current topic that you read about quite a bit, gender identity, how you view yourself, how others view you. What is the status of this in the workplace? We run into issues dealing with what bathroom does a person use. There's any number of issues that happen. And it is important to question, is the issue of gender identity, how do you view yourself or how do others view you? But I'm going to open that up to both of you.
I think Jenny raised that as an issue on topics that we would talk about. So I'm going to defer to Jenny. And I have a lot of thoughts on that, but Jenny, run with that.
Yeah, I definitely want to hear your thoughts because this is such a big issue right now. My clients are asking me questions about this quite a bit. Gender identity is determined by the person living within that gender. And in California, this is very explicitly protected, the way you express your gender, the way you identify it, the way it is perceived by others. If someone thinks that you present as one gender and discriminates against you based on that gender, that's protected. They can't do that, even if they're wrong about what your gender is. So employees are very protected in terms of defending their gender identity and expression. And employers have as yet undefined obligations. The bathrooms issue, we don't have a lot of legal clarity on it. We do know that employees should be able to use the restroom that they're most comfortable using, but some companies have what they claim are legitimate business reasons for not being able to accommodate that. Employers now have gender neutral bathrooms, which are the easiest solution. But I think we're moving toward a more open sort of bathroom policy world. Would you agree, Lisa?
Yeah, I do agree. Although I had a case recently where it's disturbing, but gender neutral bathroom and a male employee put in a camera shot straight at the toilet facility and recorded, you know, very sensitive, horribly sensitive information. And I think that what companies need to be aware of when they do this, they need to think about how it could go wrong. This went very wrong for that client of mine. Very, very wrong. I won't get into the details, obviously, attorney-client privilege, but if you're going to have you're going to have like this bathroom where anyone can go in, you need to look in and look at like, it's someone putting a camera in, like it's bad. I'm just saying it's happened. I've dealt with this multiple times. So
I had a client. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm done. I'm just saying it's that created more legal risk than creating the neutral bathroom.
Right. I had a client ask me straight up. We as a culture in our company, we support our trans employees or non-binary employees, and we want to accommodate them. But we have a lot of very important investors coming through our building, and they are of the old guard. They're very traditional. They don't necessarily believe in all this newfangled stuff. Their words, of course. And so they said, you know, are we allowed to, you know, make rules that would make them more comfortable because we need their funding to survive? And ultimately my advice to them was that they did need to make a decision about their company culture and whether or not they wanted to reinforce that kind of behavior, because unfortunately we can't depend on the courts to make these changes for us. We have to actually make them and drive that movement. And so I think the time has come where all the excuses about why we can't accommodate trans and non-binary employees have to just be disposed of. But that is something I get asked a lot, because even if a company says, oh, we really want to support people, but also we're worried about, you know, what people will think of us, you know, legally they can probably do any number of things, but, you know, morally, what do they want to do? That's something they have to think about.
So Jenny, I get the Idaho investor issue completely. I'm on the same page with you, but I think companies in California have to behave properly and do the right thing. And I've represented a number of companies where their failure to do so has resulted in litigation, and I guess I question whether or not that really benefits the investors after all, if they're getting sued, right?
Yeah, from a purely financial perspective, there's that too. It is a liability.
You know, we're near the end of the time. We have just a couple minutes left. And one positive thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is, this is a new world for all of us, and that includes executives. And when an executive is looking for a new position, what should they start? And what should they really be negotiating for when they start a new position?
Hey, I'll take that like in 2 seconds. They should really understand what the company culture is. They should really understand the company policies and how they're managed, and make sure that they're working in a company culture that really matches their personal perspective of culture and potential liability issues. They need to think about it. I mean, Jenny, you run with it.
Yeah, no, I agree with that for sure. And from a practical perspective, I always encourage the executives that I advise on this is to set yourself up with some kind of exit package. Make sure that part of your offer letter is a guarantee of severance if, you know, you're fired, you know, not through your own fault, or if you quit for a good reason. And if, you know, your company is doing really immoral stuff and you feel like you have to quit, you'd be able to walk away with some kind of package in that event. Companies won't always agree to those terms, but it's definitely worth asking, and not everybody knows they should ask for it.
We have about 1 minute left for each of you. If anybody has any closing thoughts they want to impart. Lisa?
No, I'm just so honored and humbled to be on the same stage with Jenny. Jenny is an incredible employment attorney. I highly recommend her for everyone. She's just terrific. So thank you.
Feeling is mutual, and I look up to you, and you have a broader experience than I do, and you litigate, which I'm hiding from the litigation monster. I'm now on year 3 of being a former litigator. So my hat's off to you for that.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, if I had a final point, I would say that COVID has really thrown us off of the path to getting more information from our court system on all of these employment issues. So there are a lot of things that we're not going to really understand for several years yet. So you kind of all have to, everybody has to just kind of roll with that, as challenging as it is.
I would just add that it's like literally day to day, I get questions I never got before. And Jenny, you will agree with me. You have the same practice. It's just amazing. It's hard for companies to figure out what to do. They have a lot of new government regulations and a lot of stress because they're under financial stress. So we're here to help them. That's our job. And we're here to help the employees of the state of California who need lawyers to talk to. So I think that's Jenny and I, right, Jenny?
That's right.
It's a new world, a new minefield. These two ladies have a map. Thank you both for joining us. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights as we took a look at the current environment of employment law. Tonight's show was co-hosted by Josh Borger. Our guests tonight have been from San Jose's Wegley Employment Law, Jenny Wegley, and San Jose attorney Lisa Chapman. Tonight's show was produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. Please be sure to turn in to Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 p.m., where we will take a look at the First Amendment and social media. Again, a big thanks to tonight's guests and to Josh Borger, and our thanks especially to all of you for joining us. And at the controls, Damian D. Miner, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Laura Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the law related to your situation. For the details, you can dial 415-989-1616 or you can visit sfbar.org. Thank you so much for listening and supporting KALW San Francisco at 91.7 FM.